What is the future of the Irish Defence Forces? Years of neglect by successive Irish governments has undermined its ability to fulfil its mission. Today's programme looks at the pending crisis facing the Irish military. Will they be capable of protecting Ireland from external threats in the years and decades ahead? Or is it too late? Will the Irish public ultimately end up paying a heavy price for the state's indifference to defence? I'm John Mooney. Welcome to The Dark State. To discuss this issue, I am joined by Dr. Cathal Berry, who is a TD for Kildare South. Cathal is also a former member of the Army Ranger Wing, the elite special forces branch of the Irish military. I am also joined by Conor King of RACO, the Representative Association of Commissioned Officers. Gentlemen, welcome to The Dark State. Cathal, I am going to go to you first. What is the current situation in the Defence Forces?
Good morning, John. Yeah, look, I guess if I was looking for a phrase to sum up the current state of defence forces, it would be that it's a shadow of its former self, really. And even if you rewind the clock 10 years back, I mean, we weren't just, contributing to the mission in Chad. We were actually leading it. So we were leading a European Union level significant overseas mission in the middle of the desert, in the centre of a different continent. And the organisation could not physically and possibly do that at the moment. So 10 years ago, the strength of the Defence Force was 10,500 people, and they were at full strength at 10,500, and currently it's 8,500. That just tells you any organisation that reduces its headcount by over 20% over a 10-year period, it's going to be a major impact on capability and on morale. And there is a significant morale issue in the Defence Force at the moment. It's all pretty much down to poor pay, poor infrastructure, and then I suppose a grey area in relation to purpose. Like, purpose is almost as important as pay. They feel very, very abandoned and neglected by the authorities of the state. And like any good military person, they always judge someone by their deeds, not by their words. And when people are telling them to do a great job and, you know, with loads of pride in you, but at the same time, they're undermining their industrial relations ability to fight for better rights and fight for better pay. And that really, really compromises people's perspective in relation to why they're actually in the Defence Force. And that's why so many people are leaving. I mean, the statistics that were released last Thursday in the Defence Estimates for 2021 were absolutely staggering, that even during a recession in the last 3 years, the number of people, the net loss in the Defence Forces were 385 people, even in the last 3 years. And simultaneously, and this is very concerning, that the net increase in civil servants in the Department of Defence was 22 over the exact same time period. So that is a red flag in any organisation when the number of administrators are increasing and the number of frontline operators are reducing, are in free fall. So 22 increase in civil servants in the last 3 years and 385 net loss from the uniformed services. And that's just an unsustainable position to be in.
What is driving that change?
Well, there's two factors. We'll just talk about the uniformed side of the house first of all. The two factors are the pull factor and the push factor. The pull factor obviously is there is better paid employment out there, and not just in the private sector, but in the public sector. Because, for instance, a paramedic in the Defence Forces is paid significantly less than a paramedic in the HSE. Same story as a doctor. So even though they have precisely the same qualifications, and in many cases attended the exact same course at the exact same time as their civilian counterpart, but the pay levels are significantly reduced. So people are leaving the Defence Force to even work in different parts of the public sector. So that's the pull factor. And the push factor then is they feel completely disenfranchised and disillusioned by working within the defence community in this country, that they feel totally taken for granted and totally exploited. So hopefully that answers your question from the uniformed side of the house. From the civil service side of the house, I mean, I must emphasize, I get on very well with civil servants. My constituency office is on Station Road in Newbridge, and a number of them do come in, and a lot of them share precisely the same views that we're discussing now. They see the issue themselves. But there is a big problem with the level of micromanagement and the level of bureaucracy that the Department of Defence, enforces on the Defence Forces. And there's already a massive amount of encroachment and I would say overreach there. But when you're increasing the number of civil servants by 8% over a 3-year period, I mean, that will only increase the micromanagement and encroachment even further. And that is a very, very concerning trend, that the number of frontline people are in free fall, that the number of backroom support and administrative people are increasing, and that's not going to end well.
Connor, can I ask you about the following? We continually hear about low morale in the armed forces. Is it really that bad? For example, I've heard a lot of debate about retention levels. Can you explain to the listeners how this issue is unfolding and the absolute impact that it is having on the military and its capabilities?
Yeah, John, thanks for the opportunity. I'd like to say first that it's doubly frustrating from the Defence Forces perspective and for myself as the head of a representative association, because the Defence Forces has an awful lot of really positive aspects and could be such a wonderful career. Like, there's few careers today that can offer the same sense of identity or camaraderie and individual collective pride in the state that life in the Defence Forces can. And there's so much that we do well as an organisation, you know, training and education, overseas deployment, maritime security, air ambulance, you know, but we've been undermined by a lack of resources and continuing capability. And it's a simple and sad fact that our members are completely undervalued and overstretched at the moment. And what's happening is they're leaving the Defence Forces for more stable opportunities in the public service and in the private sector at an unsustainable rate. That's basically led us to the unfortunate situation, and the Defence Forces have been in a state of slow decline for almost a decade at this point, and it's becoming irreversible. Like, we've had numerous reviews and commissions which have touched on the root cause of this decline, which is the failure to adequately resource defence in Ireland in order to retain highly qualified and experienced personnel to maintain our defence capability. If I was to try and add a bit of colour to those statements, you know, we have had an identifiable dysfunctional cycle of turnover, and this was identified by University of Limerick researchers into 2016 and 2017, and it's led to an ever-decreasing pool of suitably qualified and experienced personnel. And, John, in an organisation whose stock and trade is the profession of arms and the management and execution of lethal force, this really is a grave risk. Since 2016, the Defence Forces has brought in over 3,100 personnel, which sounds great, but we've also lost nearly 3,700, which was 41% of this average strength for those for the last 5 years. So, you know, this has led to also a crippling recruitment effort, which is organic to the organisation and causes its own strains, which has been delivered by our members, of course. But unfortunately, no amount of water has been able to fill the leaky bucket that the Defence Forces has become. And while new blood is absolutely welcome at all times in any organisation, but not at this rate. So the dysfunctional cycle of turnover is what's causing, you know, the problems in the Defence Forces and leading to the low morale that you mentioned.
I'd like to ask you both about the following, and it is what I believe is a significant issue which is impacting on the Defence Forces, and that concerns the public's view of the Defence Forces and what it actually does. Do you believe that the public has been almost miseducated on this, that they no longer understand what the Defence Forces do, the roles they play? When you talk about to people about the Irish military, they simply usually refer to it as a peacekeeping force that's sent to Lebanon. They don't understand the other tasks and duties that it carries out, which are primarily about defending the state. Cathal, could I ask you for your opinions on that? Do you believe that that is the case, and the Defence Forces have a big, big issue on their hands in terms of ensuring that the public understand what they actually do and the value that they contribute to society?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, John. First of all, I think the public have a very good understanding of what the Defence Forces do, and I think they have a very high regard, and I think it's you know, correctly, that they have a very high regard for the reputation of our Defence Forces. I think where the problem lies is that there is a misunderstanding in relation to defence itself as a concept. And if you go back to the root cause of this, and it probably goes back, dates back to the Civil War. So this is a historical legacy that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, who have formed the majority, in fact, all of the governments for the first 100 years of this state's existence, they couldn't even touch on the defence topic because it was so sensitive, it was so controversial, and it was so delicate. So we didn't really have a defence policy. We were forced into one in around the emergency period during the Second World War. When it came to the 1960s, they could agree, both parties could agree on sending our troops overseas in a peacekeeping role. But it was such a contentious topic for decades that it was actually just completely ignored. And over time, over generations, there's a complete, blind spot from a public's perspective in relation to what the role of defence is as a concept and how important it is. Now, I think there's light at the end of the horizon because there has been a bit of a shift in the public mood, particularly among the younger generation, who see a significant affinity towards the European Union. And even some recent poll results state that there is an understanding among particularly the younger generation that Ireland needs to stop being a freeloader from the defence perspective, that we shouldn't take anything for granted. And if we expect European Union partners to come to our aid in times of crisis, then we should also be prepared to come to their aid when they're experiencing a crisis themselves.
Conor King, what are your views on that?
I'm not sure whether the public have been miseducated about what the Defence Forces does. It is possible, however, that certainly domestically in Ireland, we've become less visible over the last number of years. And there's always a need to raise and enhance public awareness of what the military does. And we also need to take responsibility for that in order to proactively engage with the public. Like, the public are well aware of the secondary roles that the Defence Forces does. It has seen us as almost an auxiliary workforce in times of natural disaster, flooding, etc. But the primary role of the Defence Forces, John, is protecting the state against aggression. And that does not seem to be well understood in this country. Like, if we look at the capabilities that currently exist in the Defence Forces, like, enhanced capability ensures the protection and health and safety of our personnel and improves retention. But, you know, when we don't have critical enablers possessed by normal military forces like strategic airlift, etc., you know, then we really are not getting even off the starting block. Look at the level of defence funding and see what the priority is of defence in this country. Less than 0.3% of GDP. This is dangerously inadequate. And again, the question I would ask is, what defence services do we not provide the citizens of this state that other EU armed forces provide? And does this capability gap, for example, pose any strategic risks to Ireland and our own EU partners? Like, we should never apologise for the maintenance and resourcing of our state's insurance policy. And the Defence Forces is the state's insurance policy. And, you know, without being glib, you know, we should always have a fully comprehensive insurance policy, but the lack of resourcing that has gone into defence over the last number of decades means that really we're only working off third-party insurance. You know, look at our lack of cyber defence capability, our airlift, our primary radar. And, you know, if we talk about the army, for example, as the land component, you know, we're supposed to be able to provide for the military a defence of the state from armed aggression. That's in the White Paper 2000. And endorsed again in the White Paper 2015. And, you know, while the Defence Forces has a standing, fully professional army that partakes in some peace support operations, our army currently fits the description of a peace support operations force that sometimes tries to be an army. You know, like, the force generation process for overseas is extremely significant and a continual drain on personnel training and logistics. In 2020, last year, for example, almost 25% of the army deployed overseas. Our naval service has to be equipped and prepared to respond to counter-identified threats with an appropriate fleet size. But, like, we have an establishment for 6 ships and a fleet of 9 at the moment. And again, we're all aware of the issues with the Air Corps in terms of strike or intercept capability or primary radar. So, again, what I'm trying to say is, you know, this boils down to funding.
I would like to ask you both about your views on the new commission, which is examining the future of the Defence Forces.
Yeah, another good question, John. Look, first of all, I would say that the commission should have been completely unnecessary. So over the last 10 years, the defence apparatus in this country, it is entirely within their gift to have solved all these problems themselves. So the first of all, the establishment of the commission on the Defence Forces is an admission of failure. Absolutely. Whenever management fails, there's a requirement for the state to step in and let there be a commission of inquiry. So there was absolutely no need for this commission if the defence apparatus in this country was actually doing their job for the last 10 years. But unfortunately, the commission is now necessary, and I do welcome the formation of the commission. Now, is it likely that it's going to end up to be just another paper tiger like the white paper? And that is absolutely a possibility. In fact, if we were to look back at the trends in these strategic reviews that periodically occur within the defence forces, what you'll find is anything that's bad for the defence forces will be implemented almost immediately, really, really efficiently. But anything that's good for the defence forces takes years and years of further tortuous technical negotiation before a small fraction of it is actually implemented. So my big concern is that the Commission's report is going to be good. I'd be fairly confident that it's going to be modernising and be progressive. But the implementation piece is the key there. Will it be implemented? Will it be properly resourced? And I guess, will it get buy-in from people? I think what really is going to come out of the Commission is the use of the reserves, or the lack of use of the reserves, particularly in the last 15 months. Every country across the European Union uses its reserve defence force properly. And there's good reason for it, because you need to have that surge capacity in times of crisis. And what's incredible is, even though our defence forces are exhausted, they're absolutely burned out from their commitments over the last 15 months, we've had over 1,000 troops sitting at home that can't be deployed, and that there are reserve defence force people. So because of the legislation, because the legislation is so disabling, the reserve defence force can't be deployed operationally either at home or overseas, which is a shocking indictment of how defence policy has evolved over the last little while. So our reserve defence force, for instance, they should have been completely deployed in relation to the pandemic. Absolutely. And if not being deployed on the front line for the pandemic, at least they could have been mobilised or called up to do the camp security function of the regular defence force, so that they could be deployed on operations from a pandemic perspective. And secondly, just from a cyber point of view, even in the last 10 days, I mean, we're a technical hub in this country, a global centre of excellence for technical competence in relation to the big tech companies. We should be leveraging that 100%. So people who are working for the Google, for the Intel of this world, the state should be capturing all that expertise and having a dedicated reserve cyber unit, so that they can be deployed and assist the state in times of crisis, which we're currently undergoing as a result of a cyber attack, the largest cyber attack in Irish history in the last 10 days.
Conor King?
You know, our members could be forgiven for being slightly sceptical about another commission. and indeed, that has been voiced in some quarters that, you know, what is the point of another long-standing pseudo-independent commission or group that was going to look at the defence forces and then not implement its recommendations? Like, we have seen the lack of implementation of the white paper. We have seen the high level implementation plan, which was supposed to be the white horse to save the defence forces, failing to be implemented by those who are charged with its implementation, both on the civil and military side. So here we have another commission that is to come in and make sweeping changes for the good of the defence forces. Having said that, you know, it is required. It is certainly required that we get some external expertise to come in and do what we have failed to do in terms of adequately identifying sufficient resources in order to maintain our operation capability and actually defend the state, which is our mandate under the white paper. The expectations, therefore, are unsurprisingly high, and the stakes could not be any higher, John. The Commission has reasonably broad and ambitious terms of reference, and there's a good opportunity to reform and modernise the way we do defence in Ireland. And it should be grasped in an inclusive and holistic manner. And therefore, I suppose, without labouring the point, you know, we have gone on record as saying that the exclusion of the civil element of the Department of Defence is extremely disappointing and could be a grave error in this. Some people would say it was almost like Hamlet without the prince. When you ignore a key part of the defence organisation, it's simply bizarre. And maybe it's a missed opportunity in terms of exploring efficiencies and synergies, like tearing down silos, bringing in cross-cutting practices, But above all, really, to dispense with the kind of tired old norms, the historical tensions and the petty power struggles, and instill a real sense of unity of purpose for the benefit of the defence organisation and Irish society. Because I think, as we all know, the Defence Forces has an unhappy history of being reviewed in isolation. And the outcome of each review has generally resulted in cuts to military personnel, closure of barracks, and rationalisation in public sector speak, which has obviously increased the turnover and reduced the morale. And I hope we don't come to regret it. But the Commission is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to have a serious conversation about the range of threats facing the state. And really, you know, let's boil it down to one simple question. What's the why in terms of the defence organisation? What does the state want us to do? What resources are required to execute the mission? And if we are serious about defence and security, then there is major surgery and enormous investment required in defence forces capabilities, structures and staffing. Like, we've allowed this proud organisation to deteriorate to an alarming degree through a mixture of unsuitable policy, poor pay and conditions of service, and a failure to invest in our people and structures. And I would echo what Cathal says in terms of the recommendations. They have to be bold and ambitious. But I would caution against a failure to implement, which we have seen in the past. Like, one of the terms of reference which concerns me says that in arriving at its findings and recommendations for arrangements for the effective defence of the country, the Commission will have regard to the level of funding provided by government for defence. Now, we know what the level of funding provided by government for defence is currently, and we really have to earnestly hope that this funding will be adequate to meet the demands generated by the expert recommendations and not constrained by the resources available. Because, you know, we like to say planning without resources is just dreaming. We have a really poor track record of policy implementation in the defence sector, from the white paper to the high-level implementation plan. And if this Commission on the Defence Forces is to have real credibility and deliver much-needed and tangible reform, then these recommendations have to simply be fully resourced and accompanied by a strong implementation oversight body, and that may ensure that its good work is not allowed to wither on the vine. If that happens, and it is a big if, then there is a bright future ahead for Óglaigh na hÉireann.
In that regard, could I ask you, maybe Conor first, Ireland will face serious security challenges in the decade ahead. The world is changing. There's lots of different new forces, there are new threats which Ireland will face. What role do you think the military will ultimately end up playing in this new world that we live in?
I'd like to make the point, really, that the military will end up playing either a direct or a supporting role in the face of all security challenges that the Irish state will face, from climate change and other natural disasters to public health emergencies like the Black Swan event we've seen with COVID-19, or even attacks that you've just referenced in cyberspace. And the point that is very important to make is that if we want a force that can surge and respond for those threats, then we really have to start investing and planning now. You know, we have failed to resource defence. We have failed to have an adequate, fully comprehensive insurance policy for the state. There is still time to do that. And you're right in saying that the Commission on the Defence Forces, I think, can be flexible and can adapt to ongoing threats. They can use the current threat as an opportunity to refocus perhaps on stuff that maybe was not going to be a priority. For example, cybersecurity, cyber defence, intelligence. These are things that are not widely referenced in Irish society. They are things that are understandably not readily understood because there is not a great public discourse on cyber defence or intelligence. But perhaps this will now bring it further to the forefront. And if we can actually get our act together and start looking at investing in defence, investing in the establishment, and when I say establishment, I mean the actual headcount, which allows us to surge and to meet these threats, then I think it's an opportunity to counter these threats. Again, implementation will be key, though, John, in order to actually be able to meet the threats going forward.
Cathal Berry, could I get your opinions on this?
Yeah, the threats are fairly well out there now at this stage. Obviously, cybersecurity, that's a drum that we've been banging for a number of years at this stage. It didn't just occur in the last 10 days. Climate change, geopolitical risk from China, from Russia, who are affecting the Muslims a lot more. Brexit as well from a naval perspective. But the real wild card for me is the situation in Northern Ireland and the fact that it's becoming very destabilised now. And that's going to play out before this decade is out. A lot of it hinges on how Scotland is going to go in the next 10 years. Because Scotland leaves the United Kingdom, leaves six counties very, very isolated up north with a lot of possibility for, for the return of violence within Northern Ireland, but also for a spillover into this jurisdiction as well. So that's certainly a big threat out there. And one thing just following up on Conor's point, and I agree with him entirely, that you cannot surge capability. You cannot create capability overnight. It must be developed over years prior to an event happening, and that's where we're falling down. And it's a pity that it took a major cyber attack 10 days ago for us to sit up and listen. And even though, a lot of people who have, a lot of expertise have been not only calling for this, but pointing out exactly how to change this over the last number of years. But unfortunately, nothing has happened. Nothing has taken place. And one thing I would like to see is a bit more of involvement from the Joint Oireachtas Committee on Foreign Affairs and Defence. That's an all-party Oireachtas Committee that sits pretty much every week. And like any Oireachtas Committee, it should shadow the departments that it's responsible for. So it is a parliamentary oversight committee. And we regularly ask the question ourselves that what level of dysfunction in the defence forces is the government or Department of Defence willing to accept? And I think another question is, what level of dysfunction is the Joint Oireachtas Committee on Foreign Affairs and Defence will be allowed to accept from a defence force perspective? So I'd like to see the Joint Oireachtas Committee flexing its muscles a lot more. Its job is to forensically scrutinise the performance of the defence apparatus in this country. And to be quite honest, over the last 10 years, I would say the Joint Oireachtas Committee is equally culpable, at least equally culpable in relation to what happened. Because there's a lot of very senior backbencher members on the Joint Oireachtas Committee, and they have listened to the testimony of RACO, of PD Fora, of RD Fra, and they've written, a couple of letters, but there's been no follow-up and no action. And all it takes is for a lot of those, very influential backbenchers to pick up the phone and speak to their party colleagues who happen to be senior ministers in relevant government departments and to bring about change. And that hasn't happened yet. So, look, hopefully we'll see a bit more involvement of the Joint Oireachtas Committee on Foreign Affairs and Defence in defence issues, particularly in the lifetime of the 33rd Dáil. I think that can only be a good thing.
Before we conclude, I would like to ask some questions which have been submitted by our listeners from around the world. So I'll ask Conor for your views on the creation of an Irish intelligence service. Do you think that's a good idea or a bad idea?
John, I think you can't invest enough in national intelligence, and there probably should be an Irish National Intelligence Service. We would have made a submission to the Commission on the Defence Forces, a short 2-page submission advocating for a proper collaboration but also demarcation between the Garda Síochána and the Defence Forces in terms of national intelligence. I think we are probably, to coin a phrase, in the halfpenny place compared to other countries in terms of our own intelligence service. But it takes massive amounts of investment. For example, the surveillance costs an awful lot of money and takes an awful lot of headcount or manpower, as they say. These are not things that you can develop overnight. So we probably need to incentivize and to retain an intelligence capability, by investing in our intelligence services, again, as part of our state's insurance policy.
And one final question for both of you. Do you think the state should look at creating new pathways into the defence forces for people with specialist skills? Conor, could get you quickly to comment on that.
Yeah, we'd always welcome the influx of highly skilled personnel to feed the needs that we identify to counter the threat. If I cast my mind back to the Public Service Pay Commission, which was the last
white horse that was supposed to save the defence forces. The commission, which was housed under DPIR but was, you know, ostensibly independent, made, you know, a very strong recommendation in terms of retention of specialist capability. And it said, you know, and I'll try and quote it, it said, the defence forces is at a critical juncture, and it is clear to us from our research that without urgent and substantial intervention in terms of pay, allowances, and pension entitlements, the defence forces will struggle to continue to fulfil its mandate. Now, when the commission reported a number of months later, you know, 2 or 3 months later, it made no recommendations on pay and no recommendations on pension entitlements. Bizarrely, the commission identified the retention of cybersecurity officers, the retention of intelligence officers, the retention of engineers, bomb disposal officers, etc., as a key strategic risk facing the defence forces, and then made absolutely no recommendations for their retention. So, you know, do we recommend or do we endorse pathways to come in? Absolutely, but we have to be able to retain them. There is no point spending so much money inducting people, training them at great expense to the state, and watching them walk away for better pays and more stable employment.
Cathal, can you quickly comment on that?
Yeah, Conor is definitely talking my language there. For sure, retention is infinitely more important than recruitment. So the current model really is somebody joins the defence forces, is trained to an exceptionally high standard, and can no longer afford to stay in the defence forces because pay is so poor, and then leaves. So it's like an organisation buying a sports car and giving it away for free 3 or 4 years later to one of their competitors. It makes absolutely no sense. So retention is the key. And very, very small changes could have a disproportionately positive results from a pay and conditions of service point of view. They're not asking anybody to move mountains. All they're asking is to be treated with a small bit of respect. And I think that's a very reasonable request. Secondary to that, then, is a recruitment pathway. And that recruitment pathway already exists. I mean, so I was a doctor in the Defence Forces. And when I retired from the Permanent Defence Force 2 years ago, there was absolutely no, effort put in to allow me to seamlessly transfer into the Reserve Defence Force. Absolutely zero. So in theory, that pathway already existed. All these specialists who leave the Permanent Defence Force for whatever should be seamlessly inserted into the Reserve Defence Force. And that's how to maintain a certain amount of capability if required. And then thirdly, if you really want to induct people from the private sector, again, the Reserve Defence Force is the obvious pathway. It already exists. We have a load of cyber people out there, a load of medical people out there who would love to join the Defence Forces in a reserve capacity, then deploy overseas if required, or deploy from a cyber response capability if necessary as well from a state point of view. So look, there's multiple pathways. They already exist. All need to be done basically is to streamline them, but the emphasis has to be on retention. There's absolutely no point in recruiting people and then they walk out the door. All you're doing is you're assisting your competitors basically. You're bringing people in, trained to a high standard, and then watching them walk out the door. It makes absolutely no commercial or academic sense whatsoever. I mean, if we were in business, we'd be out of business with that type of model.
And that concludes this episode of The Dark State. You've been listening to Cathal Berry, TD, and Conor King of RACO. If you like this podcast, please do tell a friend or post a review on social media.